Let me explain that. The Sibylline Oracle was highly, highly respected in the ancient world. They gave voice to who was called the Sibyl, a woman of wisdom, of mystery, of knowledge of past and future and the ways of God. Women were very good at being mediums. They were very good at foreseeing things. They had much better intuitive faculties than men did. Now, the Sibyl is traditionally exempt from ordinary mortality, maybe centuries old, and she speaks from a state of ecstasy, a holy prophetess who's in communion with God. In her Greek form, she was the main female oracular figure of the Greek tradition. She was like much, much more advanced than Cassandra or some of the other prophetesses. The creation of the idea of a Jewish Sibyl by an Alexandrian Jew of the 2nd century B.C. represents the bringing of these kinds of revelations where the feminine form of Godhead has now triumphed in the Jewish mystic and wisdom schools. Now, where did this idea of the feminine come from? When was it that the feminine became important in Judaism? Because or in earlier Jewish tradition, which was very patriarchal, there were Jewish women who could be wives, and even the Jewish warrior, there was Judith and there was Deborah and so on. But there were not very many Jewish prophetesses and this sort of thing. But this changes after the return from exile and after the diaspora and after the contact with other religious cultures. The contact in Babylon of the upper educated and royal class of Jewish princes and priesthood who were held captive, and by the way, it was a common thing to do to destroy your enemy, was to take all the educated people and all the royalty and just bring them to your own city, treat them very well, but not let them run their country anymore, and then the common people were at the mercy of the conquering people. This is a very common thing that was done. During the captivity in Babylon, there was a tremendous dialogue that went on between the old form of Hebrew religion, the Hebrew priesthood, and the form that the Magi and the Zoroastrian priests had, which included a great deal of astrological and astronomical knowledge that the Hebrews did not have, and included categories of discourse and that the Hebrews had never thought about before, about what the origins of the world and all this sort of thing. The Hebrews had one idea that was very strong. They were henotheistic, the idea of one God. That was very philosophically very profound. That had been brought into existence among the Greek philosophers in the 7th century by Parmenides, who postulated the unity of Godhead and the idea of the one, and also the concept of the nous, the consciousness of God, or the logos of God, and so on. These ideas became very, very seductive to the Greek priests because they were things they'd never thought about before. And so they became not just priests but philosophers. And they used the same categories of thought but adapted them to their specific religious tradition as they did, for example, with the Genesis creation story. Well, yes, there was in the beginning on the first day this happened, yes, on the second day this happened, but it happened differently because there was only one God, not a council of gods. And light didn't emanate from him, rather he brought it into existence. He called it ex nihilo, out of nothing, and so on. So the Jewish experience was very tempered and very... this is what we call in religious history syncretism. Syncretized things happen throughout history. The idea of the Trinity, the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, is an adaptation of Greek philosophy and of Isian religion, Isis, Osiris, and the divine child, Horus, Harpocrates. As a matter of fact, when we dig up statues of the divine family, Father, Son, and Mother, from the early period in Egypt, we really don't know whether we're talking about the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, which is seen as feminine, or whether we're talking about Isis, Osiris, and Horus, Harpocrates. And the same holidays are even celebrated. The birth of Ion Horus, the divine child in Egypt, is Koyak 26, which in the Julian calendar is December 25th, Christmas. And the Epiphany of Ion Horus is what we would call January 6th today. It's the celebration of the return of the sun, and that's the day that we celebrate the visitation of the Magi and so on. The giving of gifts to children, all these things existed before Christianity. These ideas existed before Christianity. Christianity synthesized all these things. They hung their traditions upon the tent pegs of existing traditions. If you were a new Christian family in Egypt, and you were no longer, your children are no longer a member of an Nicene guild and went to an Nicene school and wore an Nicene hairstyle and so on, but were now being trained in a Christian catechetical school, and it got to be the 26th of Koyak, your kids wanted to know where their presents were. All the other kids were getting presents. Why weren't they? Well, of course, therefore that was the birth of Jesus, and so therefore the gifts of the Magi, and we give gifts. When in fact we know historically that if the legends of the New Testament are true, Jesus would have had to have been born at the time of the birthing of the lambs. He would be an Aries. He would have been born in March or April. But the mythic Jesus, the Jesus of legend, is born on the same date as Ion Horus is in Egypt. So this is the way popular religion proceeds. And when the Greek priests, when the Hebrew priests spent a couple of generations in mutual admiration society with the Magi, they opened up to a whole lot of things. It was their postgraduate education, and they came back with a lot of these ideas and these ideals. And it's at that time that we start to have the development of wisdom tradition, the falling away from things like animal sacrifice and in the temple and so on, and the development of ideas like the Book of Job and wisdom and questioning these things and getting into dialectic and developing a lot of Greek philosophical methods and so on in Hebrew religion. And this period of the Second Temple is the time when the idea of the motherhood of God becomes much more important. But the motherhood of God is represented by the Shekinah, the presence of God, or the Logos, or the Holy Spirit of God later on, or the wisdom of God, the Chachma, or in Greek, the Sophia of God. Now I'm reading from the book of the Wisdom of Jesus ben Sirach, which you can find, I think, in collections of Old Testament Apocrypha in Catholic Bibles. This is from the wisdom tradition in Israel that developed. And in the wisdom tradition, there was a great reverence of the femininity of deity. Here, wisdom, chachma, or in the Greek, sophia, is seen as the feminine aspect of God, the immanent aspect that man can be near and touch, that instructs man. And here is how God is presented. Wisdom instructeth her sons, and enlighteneth all who give heed to her. They that love her love life, and they that seek her shall obtain grace from the Lord. They that take hold of her shall find glory from the Lord, and they shall abide in the blessings of the Lord. They that serve her serve the Holy One, and God loveth them that love her. He that hearkeneth unto me shall judge in truth, and he that giveth ear unto me shall dwell in my innermost chamber. And this is wisdom speaking now. This is God speaking. And if he trust me, he shall possess me, and his posterity shall hold me fast. But I will walk with him in disguise, and at first I will try him with temptations. That means tests, harsh ordeals to go through. Fear and dread will I bring upon him, and I will torment him with chastisements, until his heart is filled with me. And I try him with my ordinances, then will I lead him on again, and I will reveal to him my secrets. If he turn away from me, I will forsake him and deliver him over to the spoilers. So here is the idea of God as wisdom, as and this is also as mother, as a teacher or trainer of the children. And she is a very harsh disciplinarian. Wisdom demands great things. And Jesus, in his concept of the Holy Spirit or the Spirit of Holiness, is drawing from all these concepts of the femininity of deity, as that is how God teaches and how God draws near to humanity, through this feminine spirit. And that's what the idea of spirit is, the spirit of God. It's a feminine thing. Ruach in Hebrew is a feminine, and the spirit of God is feminine. And so it was that women became important in delivering revelations in Israel. The Sibylline oracles that are the Jewish Sibylline oracles that come from this wise old woman. In the Greek tradition, the Sibyl was supposed to have lived in Erythra in Ionia. Clement of Alexandria gives her date as prior to the legendary Orpheus. And Augustine makes her contemporary of Achilles and so on. She became a figure of divine authority for the pagans, Jews, and Christians, and as she grew in the estimation of all these people, the number of her books increased. The Jewish apocalyptic literature was composed in Egypt in Greek hexameters in the middle of the 2nd century BC. There were originally 15 books or 12 that survive. Her words glorify the history of the Jews, denounce animal sacrifice, sexual immorality, and the worship of idols, and proclaim the truth of monotheism and the absolute sovereignty of its self-sprung invisible God. And this concept of Godhead, not only invisible, immortal, but and definitely non-anthropomorphic, but as the Kabbalistic God who creates out of himself all things, so that all things are emanations from God, not just the angels and the host of heavens as emanations of God, but everything, all human beings, all human souls, everything is an emanation of God. There's no beginning dualism where there's God and there's matter, and God infuses matter with a soul. There's just God, and God emanates himself and elaborates himself forth, and so therefore all things are Godhead. This is a very important concept. So in the Sibylline oracles, which you'll find the Jewish Sibylines, a few quotations on your pages 501 and following of the other Bible, I'll read you a few things that are interesting. Here is a messianic prophecy of the Sibyl. And then the God of heaven will send a king and will judge each man or woman with blood and flame of fire. There is a royal tribe whose family will never stumble. In the circuit of time, they will have dominion and begin to raise up a new shrine to God, and all the kings of Persia will succor it with gold and brass as well as wrought iron. God himself at night will give away his holy dream, then the temple will be as it was before. Here's another one. I am the prophetess of the mighty God who was not fashioned by men's hands like a dumb idols of polished stones. He has not made his habitation a stone set up in a temple, dumb and helpless, a bugbear of miseries to mortal. He is one whom none can see from earth, nor measure with mortal eyes, since he was not fashioned by mortal hand. With all-embracing vision he sees all, but is himself unseen. His is the murky night and day, the sun, the stars and the moon, the sea, the haunt of fish, the land and rivers and the source of perennial streams, creatures ordained for sustaining life, and showers that cause the wheat field to grow and trees and vines and olive trees. He has driven a goad right through my heart so that I will proclaim exactly and all that is happening to human beings, and that is to happen from the first to the 10th generation, etc. Here's another one. From the blessed plains of heaven, a blessed man has come with the scepter in his hand, which God committed to his clasp, and he has won fair dominion over all, and has restored to all good people the wealth taken earlier by others, etc. This is the Son of Man tradition, and so on. So this feminine impulse comes into the wisdom tradition, the mysteries, and the whole impulse of ascent to heaven, which begins very early in the prophetic schools with Isaiah, who ascends to heaven and speaks with God and is given a commission, and Daniel, who is given visions by God and who and all this sort of thing. The ascent traditions are associated very often with Enoch. Enoch is said to have been has ascended directly to heaven instead of dying. The same is said of Elijah, who ascended directly to heaven instead of dying. He was taken up into heaven, assumed into heaven, as Jesus is said to have been. So these traditions of ascent are powerful traditions. So we have the feminine impulse, the idea of sainthood, the ideal of great beings that come, that are like avatars, that come to teach divine truth to humanity. And all these are coming together, and so they're developed within the schools of the Pharisees, mystic schools, and they're called the schools of mystic ascent. They are the schools of the Merkaba mystics. Now, what is the Merkaba? The Merkaba is the chariot throne of God. It goes back to the vision of Ezekiel, of this amazing throne surrounded by the cherubim, the four beasts, and the things like wheels within wheels and all this sort of thing. And it goes back to the ancient Near Eastern ideas of God sitting on thrones on mountains and things like that. These are, of course, allegorical. But in ascent to God and to Godhead, there was deep practice that was involved and that was made by people who practiced these ascents. I'm going to read you some of the descriptions of these kinds of visions and the technique for mystic ascent into the higher heavens. You'll find this later in the Jewish magical traditions collected by Margoliouth called Sefer Haratzim, the Book of the Mysteries, and so on. But I'll find you some that are more accessible from this pseudepigraphic material. Now, in the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs, in the Testament of Reuben, the part when he talks about the seven spirits appointed against man, and they are leaders in the works of youth, and seven other spirits are given to him in his creation, that through them should be done every work of man, the first being the spirit of life, the second is the sense of sight, etc. These actually are can be correlated to the seven chakra, because they end with the spirit of procreation, etc. And then it says there are the antitypes to these, the negative and the positive aspects of the use of these seven spirits, which are very much related to what we would call chakras. And besides all these, there is an eighth spirit of sleep, with which is brought about the trance of nature and the image of death. Now, this eighth spirit is the spirit of meditation, which is compared to a divine sleep or to a trance. And meditation is compared to death. One goes into the icon of death, the icon thanatu, and so on. And this spirit is the power through which of meditation, through which people ascend through these seven heavens to the eighth heaven, to the throne of God. In some systems, it's to the tenth heaven, to the seat of God, and so on. This whole business of the seven heavens is a tradition, a Jewish ascent tradition, Merkaba mysticism. They ascend in their spirit through the powers of this eighth spirit of sleep, or of the image of death, by going into a trance into the highest heavens. However, it's a very dangerous thing. If you are not a very, very pure person, especially as you approach the seventh heaven, which is a heaven full of delusions, it's related very much to the seventh spirit in man, which is the spirit of procreation, which is the thing that deludes him most, his sexual organs and lusts and passions and so on. Then many are lost at that point. And if you read the discussions of the old Jewish fathers from the 2nd century and the 3rd century, some of the earliest Jewish saint father wise men and so on, they discuss, oh, Rabbi so-and-so went mad trying to reach the throne of God, and only one out of 1,000 people can do this, and all this sort of thing. Anyway, so these ascent traditions were very important, and those who could ascend in vision and see were considered to be very, very great saints and mystics, and that is the way the prophets heard from God and spoke in God's name. Now, there is another publication that you may be able to get. It's called The Lost Books of the Bible and the Forgotten Books of Eden. It's been out of publication for a long time. It was published by World Publishing Company in 1963. And it's, let's see, I'll give you a number on it. It was Forum Books, F256. And let's see if I can find any other information on it. Doesn't seem to have a... It has a Library of Congress catalog number of 63-19519. But the value of this, if you can find it, it's cheap. It's a paperback. You might find it in a used bookstore or something like that. And it contains some other things that your other Bible doesn't contain. It contains the correspondence of St. Ignatius, the letters to the Smyrnians and all these sort of things that are very important. It contains the Shepherd of Hermas and all the writings of the Shepherd of Hermas, and it contains the testaments of the 12 patriarchs. These are things that are not contained in this collection you have of the other Bible, but that are very important works. And this would be an inexpensive way to add it to your library if you can find this book. I haven't researched it, and the copy I have has got to be 30 years old. But I used it when I taught at the University of California in the early 70s because it was still available then. But now the other Bible is a much better collection because it's amplified. It's a lot of this material, but also amplified with the Qumran and Coptic Gnostic stuff, and so that's why I've asked you to get that. But this other book, although it repeats some of the things you have in that one, the price on this was $2.95. Of course, that was 30 years ago. But if you can find the Lost Books of the Bible and the Forgotten Books of Eden, you'll also get some other stuff. The alternative is to buy R.H. Charles, which is quite old and outdated now, but very comprehensive, and you'll pay $150 for those volumes. But if you can find the Lost Books of the Bible and the Forgotten Books of Eden, you'll have something quite good. Now, I did a great deal of study in this in theological seminary in the 60s because I realized that in order to understand Paul and Jesus and what was going on, I had to understand the context where they're coming from. And I started a study of this. I completed a bibliography of the Old Testament pseudepigrapha and apocrypha that is hundreds of pages long and very detailed, but now it's 30 years out of date. And I published that, and I've done a great deal of work in this area that most biblical people are just now starting to really discover, and came to an understanding of a great deal of these things. And one of the very important things to understanding this is the fact that the Kabbalah, the Kabbalistic ideas that we associate with medieval Judaism, existed back then in this tradition. Those conclusions have been reached by Jewish scholars and others too. Your other Bible has a very good section on this. And I'm going to quote you a little bit from his introduction because it's quite good. The actual origin of Kabbalah has its sources, according to Gershom Scholem, who is the foremost scholar of Jewish mysticism, in the esoteric and theosophical currents existing among the Jews of Palestine and Egypt in the era that saw the birth of Christianity. That is, among the Jews that were practicing Merkava mysticism, which turned into the Hekaloth mysticism, a much more complex form of meditation into the halls and byways of heaven and so on. We've already seen the apocalyptic and mystical tendencies in the pseudepigraphic literature of the intertestamental period, such works as the Book of Enoch, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Qumran sect, and the writings of the Jewish Gnostic contained the elements of Kabbalah, which were to characterize its first document, the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation. These elements were the mystical chariot, or Merkaba, of God, the Sefirot, virtues, and their relation to the letters of the Hebrew alphabet and the cosmogonies and anthropogonies. The throne on its chariot goes back to the first chapter of Ezekiel, and this throne of glory is a source of a long mystical and visionary tradition, really
going back to Isaiah. As for the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation, was written, Sholem contends, by a Jew in Palestine between the 3rd and 6th centuries. In that first Kabbalah, we already find the linguistical, mystical cosmogony, that is, the magical power of letters, which precedes the word. So we read about, quote, the letters in which heaven and earth were created. The word Kabbalah was used to designate any secret mysteries or whispered statements of sages. But by the time of Isaac the Blind in AD 1200, Kabbalah, also written as C-A-B-A-L-A in Spanish, superseded other designations for Jewish mystical literature and so on. But actually, Kabbalah means that which is given from the mouth of the teacher to the ear of the hearer in confidence and so on. Now, the Zohar is attributed to the Spanish Kabbalist Moses de Leon, who died in 1305. Its source is in the ancient Midrashic works of the first centuries A.D., and much of it is a Kabbalistic commentary on the Torah. The language is Aramaic, so it's very ancient. Its mystical content is related to the Sefirot, which Moses de Leon elaborates, and so on. So we know now that the Kabbalah is very ancient, that it existed at the time of Jesus, and we know now that it was part and parcel of the Merkaba mystic traditions that Paul was obviously very associated with, and the trance and the mystic ascent traditions such as those of Enoch, and also the messianic schools that developed in Babylon, the Son of Man school, and so on. Now, what are these ideas? I'm going to read you a very simple thing. In the beginning, this is Genesis, when the will of the king began to take effect, he engraved signs into the heavenly sphere that surrounded him. Within the most hidden recess, a dark flame issued from the mystery of Ein Sof. That means not limited. The infinite, like a fog forming in the unformed, enclosed in the ring of that sphere, neither white nor black, neither red nor green, of no color whatever. Only after this flame began to assume size and dimension did it produce radiant colors, blah, blah, blah. It's very much like the Gnostic speculations that I could read to you from Basilides and so on about the origins of there was no thing and there was no not anything and not anything. There were just plainly no thing, and out of this absolute nothing come God manifests. And God is first the Ein, which means not, the nothing, the non-existent. And then, as he begins the process of emanating and unfolding himself, he becomes the Ein Sof, which is the not limited, the infinite. So from non-existence to infinite existence. And then in the third stage, the Ein Sof Aur, the not limited or the infinite light. God is light. And that is his first manifestation, as in the let there be light, fiat lux of the Old Testament and so on. And from that then is emanated the Sefirot and then the paths, the Hebrew letters, the four worlds, which are the primal world of divine manifestation, and then the world that manifests, it is the place of the archangelic beings, and then the third world, which is the place of the angelic beings, and then the world of Yetzirah, which is of the lowest aspect of which Malkut is what we call the physical cosmos. So there is a concept of reality and all reality of God as being universes of universes. It's like the Hindu concept of myriad universes and myriad creations, and of which ours is just a tiny, tiny, tiny part at the lowest part of manifestation. And the most significant thing about it is that it's Gnostic. God emanates. All things are God. All beings are born of God. Manichaeism, Gnosticism, all these things do originate from Jewish, Kabbalistic, Gnostic thought. And the earliest Christians were of this persuasion, and they practiced these kinds of practices and these kinds of mystical ascent and so on. You can read more about this. Just a couple of more things I want to call your attention to. the Zadokite document, those who were of a different priesthood who separated themselves. You'll find some literature from that. You will find the Qumran material, the manual of discipline, the using of bread and wine as sacraments, and the washing of hands, and the long disciplines and initiations they went through as Essenes. You can read about the from the Damascus document, that's the Zadokite document, about their Sabbath rules and so on. You can read about their vegetarian or their non-animal sacrifice sacred meals of bread and wine. You can read their Thanksgiving Psalms and the whole generation of Psalms that's still being written and created for many, many years after the Psalms in the Old Testament. They don't just stop. They just keep on going. And the Psalms that Jesus sang were undoubtedly Kabbalistic Psalms and not so much the Old Testament Psalms that we know. And you can read from the story of the war between the sons of light and sons of darkness, a Kabbalistic army fit together with Kabbalistic banners and magical statements and so on to fight the final battle. So this is a beginning for you to see what the whole length and breadth of this incredibly huge field is. And I hope that you take advantage and educate yourself about these things.